General Accounting Office under the Comptroller General makes independent examinations of the way that government agencies fulfill their financial responsibilities. The Comptroller General has access, with limited exception, to the papers of all departments. He also determines accounting procedures, settles accounts for disbursing and collecting officers, and renders decisions on the legality of expenditures of public funds. In many respects, the Congressional Counsel General would be far more limited than the Comptroller General in that he will have no access to papers, nor will he have any decision-making powers affecting the other branches of government. There are certain built-in checks on the Counsel General. First, he must have authority of either the House or Senate Judiciary Committee to enter a court as amicus. Second, his position as amicus is limited to presenting the viewpoint of Congress on the constitutionality of its laws and to representing Congress and assisting the courts to ascertain the meaning of its legislation. To the extent that his views on the meaning of legislation are solidly based, he will be respected by the courts. However, to the extent that he would come under control of some political faction, he would tend to be disregarded by the courts. There will be a great deal of restraint acting on any man who dares to represent the legislative intent of Congress and act as lawyer representing the Congress. Like a private lawyer, he must represent his own client and also be persuasive to the court. It is indeed the quality of the counsel which will determine his success. Furthermore, there is essentially nothing new in this function, since the Congress already has someone interpreting its intent in the form of the Attorney General. However, no matter how fine a lawyer he may be, the Attorney General is still a part of the executive branch which the Congress is seeking to control and cannot escape representing the interests of the executive branch. The counsel of Congress should be the finest legal counsel Congress can obtain. And although this proposal limits his term of office to 4 years, it's probable that he would remain in office even as the composition of the Congress changes. That is not only because his appointment is to be made without regard to political affiliation, but also because Congress would hesitate to remove a man who conscientiously attempted to ascertain the meaning of legislation and represent the interests of Congress as an institution. Congress would hesitate to politically devalue an office which would be so valuable to it. It is not, however, inconceivable the Congress may decide that its counsel has failed to maintain those high standards which it hopes. In such cases, it would be the congressional interest to name a new man, and thus the power of the Congressional Counsel General would be directly proportional to his loyalty to ascertain as accurately as possible the meaning and intent of the legislation. In regard to the functions of the Congressional Counsel General, the Counsel for Congress under my bill would perform functions at several stages of the legal process, subject to such rules as the Committee on Judiciary of the Senate and the House of Representatives may prescribe jointly from time to time. First of all, the Congressional Counsel General would perform such duties with respect to legislative review of executive actions as shall be prescribed by such rules. Congress often fails to take into account all the factors which later arise in the administration of legislation. In order to encourage administrative agencies and departments to respect congressional legislation, Congress must do a far better job of legislative oversight. Thus, the Council of Congress could assist Congress in the initiation of new and corrective legislation. By reviewing the actions of the courts and the administrative agencies, he will uncover areas of policy where there is no existing legislation, or where the existing legislation is unclear, or where the legislation is in effect being made by the executive. Each year, the Council could present to Congress an agenda of law revisions with recommendations and alternatives to be considered. This would greatly help Congress perform its oversight and legislative review functions. Emphasis upon this particular role of the Counsel General may very well reduce the role he will have to play in subsequent court proceedings. Second, the Counsel of Congress would render to committees and members of the Congress advice with respect to the purpose and the effects of provisions contained in the Acts of Congress are to be inserted in proposed legislative measures. This, the Council would provide upon request confidential advisories on the effects and constitutionality of proposed legislation during the legislative process so that the legislation will have more likelihood of having effect and being enforced. Third, the Council of Congress would render to committees, members, and disbursing officers of the Congress and the Comptroller General legal opinions upon questions arising under the Constitution and laws of the United States. the Congressional Counsel General, through the rendering of legal opinions upon the laws of Congress to committees of Congress, will provide a way for members in the committees of Congress to present an authoritative viewpoint to the executive departments and agencies upon the validity, but not the merit, of regulations such as the new anti-dumping regulations or the various income tax regulations. In this capacity, the Council will speak authoritatively in the sense of being the Council representing Congress. However, he will have no dictatorial powers, inasmuch as any department or agency will still be able to promulgate any rules it wishes and then test their validity in the court. In this capacity, the Council of Congress could maintain, with the coordination of the respective members of Congress, the history, purpose, and intent of legislation, so that after enactment of legislation, there will be a complete and authoritative legislative history. This legislative history would become a part of the material to be sent to the President with a bill and entered into the Federal Register or similar publication. This will not only enable the executive to perform its function better, but also assist future councils of Congress in performing their function of rendering legal opinions and representing Congress before the courts on the meaning of its laws. It should be noted that the proposal does not seek to integrate the legal staffs of the committees or legislative council. This is deliberate in order to maintain the pluralism of views within the Congress, which the Congress's present system provides. Fourth, the Council would appear as amicus curiae upon the request or the approval of the committees of the Judiciary, the Senate, or House of Representatives in any action pending in any court of the United States in which there is placed in issue the constitutional validity or interpretation of any act of Congress or the validity of any official proceeding of or actions taken by either House of Congress or by any committee, member, officer, office, or agency of the Congress. The courts will still have the right to determine who may appear as amicus curiae, but this section will make it possible for the courts to accept the Congressional Counsel General in the capacity of lawyer for the Congress. Fifth, the Council would represent, upon request or with the approval of the Committee on the Judiciary, the Senate, or House of Representatives, either House of Congress or any committee, member, officer, office, or agency of the Congress, in any legal action pending in any court of the United States to which such House committee, member, officer, or agency is a party, in which there is placed in issue the validity of any official proceeding of or action taken by such House committee, member, officer, or agency. The Council General would be authorized to replace the Attorney General in this capacity. Now, the reason for this stems from the peculiar interest of Congress in these cases and the right of Congress to prosecute its own contempt cases. Although this authority has been in the past delegated to the Justice Department, the existence of a full-time congressional counsel would make it appropriate that he be responsible for a case within the traditional powers of Congress. The purpose of these provisions is to restore the authority of Congress to make valid law. Individual congressmen or committees could follow the course of a bill after its enactment, but a Congress has its hands full with current legislation. Furthermore, no one congressman can speak with such authority, nor can a committee coordinate these efforts without a large staff working in this area exclusively. On the other hand, it has been suggested that the Justice Department could be made into an independent agency, but the question would then arise as to how to control it and to how to make it responsible and responsive to the people. The Congressional Counsel General would be tied directly to the legislative branch. In summary, the proposal to create a Congressional Counsel General is perhaps a novel one, but one which is necessitated by the growth of administrative bureaucracy. It's a means to assist Congress internally by assisting it in performing its oversight function by review of the executive and judicial acts, as well as by assisting in improving its legislation. It is also a means to assist Congress externally by keeping the administrative departments and the agencies responsive to Congress from which their authority is derived. In both his internal and external functions, the Congressional Counsel General will assist in making Congress a more effective branch of our government and thus strengthen the principle of the separation of powers.
I take it that in your view, one of the best ways Congress could exercise what we accustomed to call the oversight function would be to have the Council of Congress to present the views of Congress in respect to in cases involving how laws were being executed.
Exactly right.
Now, you also make the point that on many occasions Congress has a definite stake in the interpretation which is placed upon constitutional provisions. I think a fine illustration of that was the Gravel case, where the Solicitor General took a position that was very antagonistic to the views of Congress. He took the position that an aide to a senator or representative could be compelled to testify in the courts to confidential communications he had with the senator or the representative in respect to matters that were covered by the speech and debate clause. And the Senate passed a resolution and authorized Senator Saxby and myself to appear and present the Senate's views to the Supreme Court, which permitted us to engage in an oral argument. And I think we won a significant victory for Congress because they held that the aide of a senator or representative had the same protection as the senator or the representative had under the speech and debate clause, as long as he was acting within the scope of the legislative function of his employer. Then you speak of the fact that we have conflicts of interest at times, and another illustration that came before this committee a few years ago when the Comptroller General made a ruling interpreting the Act of Civil Rights Act of 1964 prohibiting the use of quotas in fair employment practices. And the Attorney General of the United States ruled directly opposite of the Comptroller General of the United States, and there we had Comptroller General had, under the then existing law, to have legal representation in the courts. He had to let the Justice Department, which was directly opposed to his views, appoint the only attorneys that were available to him.
I think the chairman is pointing out specific instances. I think that the number of cases in the court are small in comparison to the actual conflict that really exists. And let me say that this conflict of the exercise of power is one which recognizes the fallibility of humankind. And this government certainly ought to be entitled to and to have its own viewpoint represented from the congressional side as well as from the Attorney General's side. If you remember in the famous Teapot Dome case, why they had to have a whole section of the Attorney General's office set off all by itself because it found itself in almost apparent conflict with itself. And I only refer to that because it seems to represent somewhat of a repeat of the present-day situation.
Now, your bill, as I understand it, contains a provision that before the Council of Congress can actually intervene and ask permission to intervene in a lawsuit in which Congress may have a potential interest in, as an amicus curiae, that he has to get the consent of the Congress to do that.
He has to get consent of the Judiciary Committee. The Judiciary Committee of either House would control that under rules and regulations, what they would prescribe, yes.
Now, Professor Arthur Miller, who's a consultant to this subcommittee, has been discussing with me the question, this question. We have a tremendous amount of regulation written by the various departments and agencies which, for all practical purposes, have the force of law. And Congress, there we have the executive branch almost making law, you might say, contrary to the first clause of the first article of the Constitution, which says all the legislative power of the federal government is vested in the Congress. He suggested this question, whether or not it would be advisable to provide that the before a regulation issued by an executive or department agency becomes effective, that it should be submitted to the office of the Congressional Counsel and let him scrutinize it and see if it really carries out the intent of Congress. What do you think about that suggestion?
Well, I think that under this society in which we live, in this complex world, that might be an impediment to the overall operation of government, because In general, I support the idea of delegation of authority to administrative agencies. And the fact that they frequently do not perform in a function which we intend, in part, is due to the fact that sometimes they succumb to the old question of bureaucratic inaction. That's just by the very nature of a bureaucracy. This is not an initiative body, generally speaking. The same time that I do think, though, that each one of those rules or those standards in the rulemaking procedure, which is pretty well established now, that it becomes an adversary operation. I've just been involved in that in the automobile safety hearings in the Commerce Committee, for example. And it seems rather strange to me that the safety and the preservation of human life, killing some 56,000 we are a year, has to be an adversary proceeding. And it seems to me it'd be much better if we could come forward with some type of procedure where we could have, instead of confrontation, we could have cooperation. And in this viewpoint, I think that this office could provide a very valuable function. At this moment, I really don't see any way out of that trap. And I've been trying to find a way out of it. I might say that I serve on a committee on finance and on the committee on commerce, and that practically encompasses I'd say about at least 75% of the administrative agencies. So I have a good chance to see the need for more extensive oversight. I think one of the real problems in this country at this moment is, and one of the real criticism of Congress is, they think simply because we pass a law that gets action. You know, passing the law is only the first step. The execution of that law is, and how it's executed and administered. Is the important part.
You point out very well that the laws don't enforce themselves. It takes human beings to enforce them.
That's right.
But anyway, under your bill, would not the Council of Congress have authority to, with the permission of the necessary committees of the Congress, to intervene in any suit involving an interpretation of one of these regulations, if he felt that the interpretation which the agency was putting on it was contrary to the proper interpretation, or at least was inconsistent with the law under which the regulation was promulgated?
Very definitely. But let me say again that the court would make the final decision again. The authority to intervene would only be to represent the viewpoint of the Congress to make sure that viewpoint is thoroughly exposed in the best fashion as possible. But ultimately, I would not want to go ahead and in any way take away the authority of the judiciary to exercise its controlling influence in the separation of powers theory.
Have any questions?
May I ask you one question, Senator, to expand that a bit? And I'm sorry if I didn't get it in your testimony. Does your bill contemplate the power of this Consul General to intervene in rulemaking procedures, say, before the Federal Trade Commission?
Not generally speaking, the rulemaking procedure, no. Except in where there would be a specific request made in which the Judiciary Committee would then, in turn, of either House, would make a decision that this was a case where, as far as the rulemaking authority, was in complete violation. But generally speaking, it would require the decision of the Judiciary Committee. You see, the whole rulemaking procedure is pretty much established now in administrative law as a general procedure, and generally speaking, I would say that the rights of the individual to provide for protection is maintained.
Well, I think, with due respect, sir, I think some people differ on that point. There is one other question, I think, without this. Executive orders, directives, proclamations by the White House are issued by the thousands, so I understand. And there have been thousands of, uncounted thousands of them. Is there any function that you see in this office for reviewing the issuance of an executive order to see if it's in accordance with law?
Yes, very specifically, definitely. And this is a case, for example, and also an executive agreement. That is a question whether or not an executive agreement, in effect, is a treaty and having the power and effect of a treaty. And that situation is very common today. and which the treaty-making power, which again is a power which is specifically reserved to the Congress, is in many cases being bypassed. Now, let me point out again that the court itself, in the ultimate final analysis, probably would be required to make that decision. But as I said before, this would act as a restraining power in the case of resolutions of Congress and executive agreements and executive orders and things of that sort. I do not anticipate that there would be a wholesale attack upon these measures. But I will tell you that I have a few myself in which I'd like to have seen the Congress intervene.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, sir.
Very much for a very illuminating statement on it in support of your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for giving me a chance. And I want to thank you for the consideration you gave me on the floor of the Senate, making sure that this measure was heard, because we did have it on the floor as an amendment to another bill. But I do think it needs to have a great deal of study and probably some revision.
Thank you very much. Counsel, call the next witness.
Mr. Chairman, the next witness is Mr. Mitchell Ragovan, former Assistant Attorney General.
Thank you for your willingness to come before the committee and give us the benefit of your views on these matters that we're considering.
Indeed, it's my pleasure. My name for the record is Mitchell Ragovan, and I've practiced law here in Washington for some 20 years. I'm currently a partner in the law firm of Arnold and Porter. I served as Assistant Attorney General in charge of the Tax Division in the Department of Justice from 1966 to 1969. I am appearing at the chairman's invitation to comment on S-2803, a bill that would make the Department of Justice an independent establishment of the United States, and S-2978, a bill that would establish a special commission to study the establishment of a permanent independent prosecutor. To assist you in evaluating my testimony, I believe I should underscore two representations that have an effect on my testimony. I am General Counsel of Common Cause, and my testimony reflects the position of that organization. And at that time, I would like to introduce Robert Gallimore, Common Cause, who is with me. And I'm also counsel of the National Academy of Public Administration.
You might move up the witness table. We'd like to have you also.
Senator, I'm also counsel to the National Academy of Public Administration and assisted in the preparation of the report entitled Watergate, Its Implications for Responsible Government, a report that was prepared at the request of the Senate Select Committee on Presidential Campaign Activities. And specifically, I invite the committee's attention to Chapter 4 of that report dealing with the Department of Justice.
Thank you. I'll say that is a very illuminating report, which will be a much help. I'm satisfied to the Watergate Committee.
Yes, sir. Some 5 years ago, Mr. Chairman, with a good deal of prescience, you set the predicate for these hearings. When at the, you put the following question to the Attorney General Designate. Quote, Senator Ervin, Mr. Mitchell, until comparatively recent years, it has been customary for presidents to appoint the Postmaster General his chief political advisor and agitator. Unfortunately, during recent years, this role has been largely taken away from the Postmaster General and given to and exercised by the Attorney General. To my mind, there is something incompatible with marrying the function of the chief political advisor and chief agitator with that of prosecutor of crimes against the government. Now, I would just like to know whether you think that the primary function and objective of the Attorney General should be giving political advice or doing political agitating before congressional committees or enforcing federal law and acting as an advisor to the president in his cabinet in legal matters rather than political. Mr. Mitchell responded at that time, Senator, I would hope that my activities in a political nature and of a political nature have ended with the campaign. I might say that this was my first entry into a political campaign, and I trust it will be my last. From the termination of the campaign and henceforth, my duties and functions will be related to the Justice Department and as the legal and not the political advisor of the president. The answer given by John Mitchell would well have been given by a number of his predecessors, for they, like John Mitchell, would have been telling the Senate Judiciary Committee what attorneys general designate believed the committee wanted to hear, that the incompatible marriage would not be consummated. But like other attorneys general, Mr. Mitchell did in fact marry the function of chief political advisor and chief agitator with that of prosecutor of crimes against the government. Thus, the introduction of S-2803 and S-2978, which are really bills of divorcement. The administration of justice must...
Oh, incompatibility of temperament.
I certainly hope that's... The administration of justice must proceed on the basis of law and its application to fact without regard to politics. As previously quoted by Mr. Sorensen, Edward Bates, President Lincoln's first attorney general, trenchantly said, "The office I hold is not properly political, but strictly legal, and it is my duty above all other ministers of state to uphold the law and to resist all encroachment from whatever quarter of mere will and power." Now, the events known as Watergate have made self-evident that whatever the value of the once sought-after attribute of political pragmatism in a nominee for high office, it has no place in the Department of Justice. The lesson has taken many years to learn. Since the turn of the century, presidents, with notable exceptions, have appointed men who have been successful presidential campaign managers to head up the Department of Justice. In so designating a political advisor as Attorney General, each of these chief executives have added immeasurably to the existing conflicting roles of the Attorney General. When the Attorney General serves not only as the nation's chief law enforcer and counsel to the President, but also as political counsel, patronage dispenser, and re-election campaign manager designate, the resulting conflict places tremendous strain upon the Justice Department's capacity to administer justice evenly and upon the public's perception of the quality of justice that it is administering. Watergate caused ruptures at virtually every hairline crack and pressure point that had come into being within the department in the last 75 years because of the conflicting roles assigned to it. Hopefully, these hearings will serve to catalog the structural damage and blueprint change. Although I do not support the passage of legislation that would establish the Department of Justice as an agency independent of the executive branch, I strongly believe, for the same reasons that caused S-2803 to be introduced, that remedial legislation should be enacted, which would attempt to insulate the department from direct political control. Since the responsibility for the enforcement of laws in this nation is vested in the president, if the president is to be held accountable for how well the laws are executed, it would seem to place undue pressure upon the separation of powers for the Department of Justice to be outside the president's authority. Since its creation in 1870, the department has been given a steadily increasing range of functions in the American judicial process. In large measure, the unstructured growth of the department mirrored the growth of federal law and economic regulation. This growth, particularly since World War II, created an increased dependency on the part of the chief executive for the legal counsel of his attorney general. What at the outset in 1789 had been an attorney general with no department behind him is today a conglomerate agency combining the world's largest law firm with other activities directly and in some instances remotely related to the criminal justice system. Although the department's 1974 budget is sizable, some $1.8 billion, which is three times the budget it had in 1969, only 10% of that budget is spent on general legal activities. Almost half the budget, $891 million, is encompassed in the grant-making authorities of the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration, LEAA. The remainder is divided. The FBI gets 20%, the Bureau of Prisons 9%, Immigration and Naturalization 7%, and the Drug Enforcement Administration 4%. Some of the disparate functions, such as the state block grant making authority of LEAA, place the department squarely in the middle of politics, the politics of grant-making, and only further politicize the mission of the Department of Justice. Originally, LEAA focused on software, on training and research. In recent years, the LEAA grant money has been used for such things as elaborate crowd control equipment and even in one case a submarine. They're in the business of giving away close to $1 billion annually.